Support comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Jesse McKinley, the Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Welcome back, Jesse. Always great to talk to you.
Of course, Alan. Happy to be here.
Let's start. The elections. Turnout was huge, and we've now learned a lot because of absentee ballots. The state Senate has, as a result of that, a supermajority. Your thoughts on what all of that means?
Well, I think for Democrats, it's a very good sign. I mean, they had obviously trailed after election night. I think a lot of people had misconstrued those kind of machine returns the day after to make it seem as though the GOP had a big night, including, of course, Rob Ort, who runs the Senate minority, and Nick Langworthy, who's the GOP state chairman, both of whom kind of declared victory the day after Election Day. Rob Ort said that they were going to win 4 to 6 seats in the Senate and kind of narrow that minority to, you know, just a couple of seats. But as the absentees came in and we were talking about hundreds of thousands of absentee ballots, those margins, shrank and then disappeared entirely to give Democrats possibly as many as three to four seat gain in the Senate, which of course, as you mentioned, gives them a supermajority. Now the practical impact of that is going to be that they have veto-proof majorities in both the Assembly and the Senate, which could conceivably shift the balance of power there, right? Because the governor would not be able to necessarily veto things and not be assured that the legislature can override his vetoes. So it does change the balance of power there a little bit. We'll see how willing the Democrats are to kind of use that power if and when they get back in the session in the new year.
Well, the big one, of course, Jesse McKinley, is the idea of soak the rich. People in both houses have put forward the idea that, you know, the rich should pay more in taxes. Cuomo has never loved that. What does that come down to?
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. Never loved is an understatement. He does not like this idea at all. And his rationale is, look, if you soak the rich and you hike their tax rates, eventually they're going to get fed up with that and move out of state. Now, there's differing schools of thought as to the truth of that, but it has always been his belief that you can't tax the rich too much or you're going to destroy the tax base that you are, in fact, trying to capitalize off of. So, but that idea of raising taxes on the wealthy has gained momentum, particularly right now, right, with the coronavirus crisis causing huge, you know, multi-billion dollar deficits in the state and in the city. And then, you know, there's only three ways to get out of a financial hole. You either cut rollback programs or you raise revenue. And the easiest way to raise revenue for many lawmakers would be to tax the rich by the justification of, well, they have the money, so they should pony up a little bit more during times of hardship. So I think of all the progressive agenda items that could be helped by more Democrats in the state Senate, that would be number one, because I think the calls for raising taxes on the wealthy are just going to continue and get louder.
Now, I talked to the governor in an interview, and he was pretty clear that this was not going to be a solid group that would vote the way their leader told them every time. I think what he was saying, Jesse, maybe you heard it differently, is I can pick off a few anytime I need them.
I think that's a completely valid point of yours and probably of his as well. I mean, you know, the Democrats, even if they run the table at this point and win the rest of the outstanding races, and there are still some outstanding races, they would probably get up to 44. So doing the math, you know, the supermajority is at 42. So, you know, on any given issue where a veto was being threatened, the governor would only need to peel off three Democratic votes. And, you know, not all Democrats are built the same. You know, some are kind of more left wing than others. Some come from moderate districts where, you know, things like taxing the wealthy may not necessarily be a popular idea. So the governor's calculus is, look, they're not going to always vote in a monolithic block. So if and when I would need to kind of, you know, convince a couple that, you know, maybe they shouldn't override a veto, you know, that's a credible argument that he would be able to make that case, particularly considering that, you know, with all things, Cuomo is always the biggest, you know, the biggest power broker in the state. You know, he controls the state party. He controls the state party's finances. He can, by dint of his popularity, help a candidate, or by dint of not paying attention to a candidate, he can hurt that candidate, particularly in, you know, kind of swing districts. So the governor still has a lot of power in this game, and he certainly knows, as you well know, how to wield that power and how to play the game.
He does. There's a new poll out that says the New Yorkers really like his emergency powers. They want him to continue. My own reading of that is nobody's ever loved the legislature, and they don't now when they say, okay, if he has emergency powers, let him have it. What do you think of that?
Well, I would almost say that it's a more psychological thing. I think New Yorkers are still freaked out. You know, I think that we're looking at a second wave now. Obviously, the state has been hit worse than any other state. Tens of thousands of New Yorkers have died. And I think there's it's almost like a PTSD situation where people are traumatized by this event and very, very wary of just going back to business as normal, particularly when you start to see rates rising and deaths rising and hospitalizations rising. It certainly does not feel like we're at the end of an emergency. So I'm not surprised at all that New Yorkers are saying don't end the emergency powers. You know, we're not at the end of the game. The governor always says we're at halftime. You know, I'm not going to torture the metaphor, but I would say we're probably in the third quarter. So, you know, it's still a long ways to go before a vaccine is readily available and everyone is safe to kind of go back to business as normal. And I think until that happens, the governor will have wide support for emergency powers.
Jesse McKinley, what do you make of the presidential election results and Cuomo? In other words, we've all known all along that Cuomo has said, and I think it's probably so, that he's a close friend of Biden's. What does this portend for New York State?
Well, I think it's good news for New York State. I mean, there's no doubt, you know, Joe Biden spoke in 2018 at Cuomo's coronation at the Democratic Party convention that year when he was facing a progressive challenge from the left from Cynthia Nixon. Biden came up to New York. He went to Hempstead. He spoke on the governor's behalf. I was there. It was a very long speech, but Biden was very complimentary of the governor. And the governor has been complimentary of Joe Biden. So I think particularly considering how contentious the relationship has been between New York and D.C. under the Trump administration, it's going to be kind of, if not night and day, at least night and twilight. You know, twilight and day. You know, it's going to be a much different relationship between the federal government and the state of New York. And New York needs the federal government's help right now. I mean, they are facing, you know, a multi-billion dollar hole. They need a bailout from the feds. The localities need money. You know, there's a lot of cooperation that New York is going to need on all manner of things, including infrastructure projects, that I think is going to be a lot easier to get under a Biden administration than from Donald Trump.
Jesse McKinley, as I interviewed Cuomo the other day, I sort of guided him into a discussion on the press. I don't think the press was in love with it. And the next day, around the world, in China, in countries all over the place, a story about inviting his mother to dinner became the top news item. Was that Get Even politics?
No, I don't think so at all. I think, actually, Alan, you asked an interesting question, and he offered a candid answer, which made news. You know, the fact that he had apparently invited his mother and two daughters to Thanksgiving dinner struck a lot of people the wrong way. That remark that he was going to have a family dinner, you know, having said, you know, a few days before, don't be a turkey, you know, don't have these big Thanksgiving dinners, you're going to cause a spike in the virus. You know, I think that struck people as hypocritical. Now, the governor's response was, oh, I hadn't told my mother yet that she couldn't come up for Thanksgiving, and I was just kind of covering for the fact that I was, you know, I hadn't broken the news to mom yet. But by that point, the genie was kind of out of the bottle. And I think what you're seeing there is not just, you know, kind of an offhand remark that made news, but also the fact that for some critics of the governor, you know, he has gotten a lot of good press and a lot of favorable coverage as a result of his handling of the coronavirus coverage, which a lot of people think has been very deft and very confident and very competent. But at the same time, I think the fact that he wrote a book about the coronavirus crisis, you know, almost putting it in the past tense when, as a lot of people have said, you know, there's still a long ways to go. I think that struck some people as kind of off key. And I think, you know, even things that were outside of his control, like, you know, the Emmy being awarded to him for a series of public news conferences, the subject of which, keep in mind, was the death of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of New Yorkers some days. I think that struck some people as a little off key as well. So, you know, the governor has a big job. He has gotten good reviews for a lot of his work in that job. But that big job also comes with big responsibilities, and part of those responsibilities is dealing with the press and dealing with hard questions. And, you know, I think the kerfuffle last week with Jimmy Vilkind, calling him offensive and obnoxious, I think that was inappropriate. You know, I think that the governor is dealt with respect by the press and generally deals with the press with respect as well. But when remarks like that are made in a public forum, it hits people's ears wrong, and I think that's what you're saying.
Maybe, but on the other hand, there's an old saying about, you know, not getting into a certain kind of match with the press because, you know, you'll lose. And they don't like to be held responsible either, as a group, it seems to me. I always argue this on our Media Project program, to the great consternation of the other panelists, but it is so that you don't really want to get into a fight with the press.
Well, I don't know. I would disagree with that. I think that journalists are actually very responsive and very responsible and listen to critiques and make corrections and, you know, go out of their way to correct the record when they get things wrong. So I think in the same way that the press does that, the governor and governmental officials are responsible for doing that as well.
What about the schools and the way Cuomo is handling that? I mean, I thought in the beginning, every time Mayor de Blasio would open his mouth, Cuomo would say, he's not in charge, I am. That seems to have gone by the wayside. Am I reading that wrong?
No, I don't think that is wrong. I think that there has been, you know, on the issue of schools, it has been interesting to watch because there have certainly been decisions, particularly early on in the crisis, where the governor did take charge and did say, you know, this is my decision. It's not up to the localities to close schools, et cetera. But then with the reopening, he kind of altered that a little bit and said, look, the localities are in charge of their own reopening plans. And thus you had this situation in New York City where the schools closed last week and or a couple of weeks ago now. And people were upset by that. And there was this issue that Joe Goldstein and I wrote about earlier this week where the trigger for that decision was 3%, you know, that 3% of the cases or tests were coming back positive. And there was some confusion as to whether the city's stats were higher than the state stats, and that led to confusion amongst parents. And I think for some parents, there's frustration not only with Mayor de Blasio, but with Governor Cuomo to an extent, that there's just not clear messaging on this, right? That they are kind of holding their breath day to day to figure out, you know, whether or not their kids are going to school. And those are big decisions and with huge, you know, real life impacts. You know, people rely on schools not only to educate their children, but also sometimes to feed their children and certainly to, you know, act as a way to allow them to go to work. So schools are a very closely watched, very important issue to a ton of people. And I think what you've seen is when the messaging from City Hall and the messaging from Albany is different or confusing or seems to be changing, I think that's when you see parents really get upset.
Now, changing to another subject, one which is interesting to me as a resident of Great Barrington, Massachusetts, we've read that 300,000 people have fled New York City. We read it in your newspaper, and not all have headed out of the state, but it points to the issue on whether New York will bounce back from this, the city of New York. I mean, some rents are going down, condo prices are going down, co-op prices are going down to some degree. What does that mean?
Well, this is just a personal opinion, as the governor would say, not necessarily backed by facts, but I think you often bet at your own peril on the decline and fall of New York City. I mean, New York City has gone through God knows how many ups and downs. You know, in the 70s, everyone said New York was over. And as a former resident of New York City, it certainly was not over when I was living there in the 90s and aughts. So the city goes through cycles. Certainly, this is a tremendously disruptive moment. You know, obviously, the collapse of the economy and moreover, the collapse of the tourism industry, which is an enormous driver of the economy in New York City, has been devastating. You know, there's no sugarcoating that whatsoever. But once again, this has only been 8 months, you know, or 8 or 9 months at this point. I think if the world is able to kind of get back on track in the next year or so with vaccines and with widespread inoculation, you know, the decline in New York City may be short term. But if something goes wrong with vaccines and the virus continues to be a part of daily life and tourism doesn't come back and the hospitality industry doesn't come back, yes, that will be a lasting damage to New York City, not only because people move out, but also because the image of the city will take a hit as this kind of cosmopolitan fun place to live and become more a place where it's in decline and people don't want to move to and kind of, you know, reinvigorate.
Now, that's a big if, of course. What do you think?
Well, I'm not buying property in New York City, mainly because I'm priced out. But I think that it's too soon to say that New York City is irreparably hurt by this. But once again, as I said before, I think it kind of depends. The next 6 months will be critical to determining which way that arrow bends.
Comptroller DiNapoli told me that the unemployment benefits paid out since the pandemic began are at least $52 billion compared to $2 billion last year. And this year isn't over yet. People need help, and New York can't do it alone. Cuomo is counting on his friend Joe Biden to help him out. What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, to go back to your previous point, this is where a Biden administration could come in very, very, very helpful for New York, particularly if the Senate can get around to passing some sort of, you know, additional stimulus bill, which has been bottled up there for months and months now. You know, I think that if they cut a deal on Capitol Hill and are able to draw down, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, which is probably what, at the end of the day, New York State would need, then once again, this may not be as terrible a blow as has been predicted. But once again, they have to get that job done. And I think the governor has said that and the legislative leaders said that even yesterday, that they really need federal help. So once again, I think the Biden administration will certainly be more amenable to that than a Trump administration. But once again, we're not in a Biden administration until the end of January. So it'll be a little while to see how that plays out as well.
Well, I will say the New York Times is, of course, the best newspaper in the world. And you have some extraordinary colleagues, Jesse McKinley, and we sort of rely on you to tell us what's up. Now, Donald Trump is done. As you know, Mitch McConnell has been extremely reticent to cross Trump. But McConnell and the ultimate insider, Joe Biden, are going to have to make some deals together. What are your colleagues telling you that may mean for New York?
Well, you know, I think a lot of eyes are obviously on Georgia. Those two runoff elections are going to mean a lot if the Democrats were able to pick up those two seats in Georgia, which is a big if in capital letters, I, capital F. Then that would obviously make things a lot easier for Joe Biden. If that does not happen, however, you know, there is a school of thought that Biden may have a little bit easier time in the Senate, in part because he knows some of these guys. Remember, you know, he's worked with these people not only as vice president, but prior to that as a senator. So he does have legislative experience and he does have personal relationships with some Republicans who may help him out. Now, in hyperpartisan times, that may not be enough, but it certainly is for Democrats. You know, if they lose both of those seats, they would be down two seats in the Senate, you know, basically short two votes of passing anything. But there are moderate Republicans, people like Mitt Romney and Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, who might conceivably see their way towards, you know, supporting Democratic packages. But once again, I think all eyes are on Georgia to see how those two runoffs play out.
Dr. Fauci had some criticism for the governor, who once told me he'd move heaven and earth if Trump fired Fauci to recruit him for New York State. And you wrote about it, criticized the governor for his plan to evaluate vaccine distribution, if I've got that right. What, in fact, do you think this portends?
Well, I think it's kind of indicative of where we are at this point in the coronavirus pandemic, is that, with the three successful vaccines, or apparently successful vaccines, we're starting to talk about not, necessarily the treatment of the disease, which obviously is critically important still, but moving beyond that to inoculation. And the governor has spent the better part of the last month, talking about this and setting up a task force to kind of not only evaluate the vaccine, but also to kind of look at its distribution. But this will be challenging. He has said this, a lot of public health experts have said this, that this will be a very difficult task to get 330 Americans inoculated, particularly if you're talking about, two different shots. So that will be not only a logistical challenge, but also, and this is another issue that they'll have to consider, is that, some people are skeptical of vaccines and some people may not want to take it, or some people, there may still be kind of partisan divides over whether or not the coronavirus is that big of a deal or what have you. So not only will it be kind of a medical healthcare challenge, but it will also be a public policy and political challenge to make sure that, people do get the shots and that we can kind of put this thing at bay at some point in the near future.
I don't know if I'm allowed to ask you this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Are you going to get a shot?
100%.
Me too.
I love shots because they give you a lollipop afterwards. So that, that always makes me happy.
Right. Unless you have diabetes, then you can't get that lollipop. So are you going to be traveling at all, Jesse McKinley?
Well, as an essential worker, I am able to travel a little bit here and there. Certainly not for the holidays, though. The CDC says you shouldn't do it. I'm not going anywhere for Thanksgiving. I'm not going anywhere for Christmas. There is ample evidence that exposing yourself to the virus in small groups in indoor settings can help spread the disease. So, I think a lot of those activities are considered dangerous by public health officials. And I think that the governor has urged people not to participate in such things. Although obviously yesterday on Monday, he said maybe his mom was coming up. That seems to be canceled now. But, I think that there is a lot of worry that small indoor functions are not really advisable right now with, more than kind of your immediate family or the people you live with.
So there are going to be a lot of New Yorkers who do not trust the vaccine. They're anti-vaxxers. But that portends risk for the general population, doesn't it?
Well, I think in writ large, even before coronavirus, there were issues with the measles. You remember that from last year or the year before? I've kind of lost track. But there were measles outbreaks in part because people were not getting their children vaccinated for measles. So as I said before, I think part of the challenge of the coronavirus vaccine will be a public education policy to assure people that it's safe, to assure people that there's no serious side effects, and to make sure that people get shots, because vaccination really only works if you get 80-90% of the population inoculated, so that people aren't spreading it, here and there. So obviously that will be a big part of the rollout of this once the FDA gets approval for it.
Now, there's this thing called COVID fatigue. I understand it. I know somebody really well who is obviously fatigued, likes to get out a lot. We should probably stay home and not go out. So does the governor, does the legislature, who has a role in ameliorating that fatigue?
Well, it's kind of an individual responsibility, I'm a big fan of hiking. I think if you've got COVID fatigue, find yourself a good trail and take a run or a walk and get some fresh air. But obviously, it's a real thing. Obviously, people are weary of restrictions. Obviously, people are weary of masks. Obviously, people are weary of social distancing. Human beings, by their very nature, are social animals. We like to see each other. We like to, hug and have family celebrations and do all the wonderful things that help make us human. And of course, the coronavirus takes advantage of things like that. So it is tough to tell people that you can't do the things you used to do that make you feel happy. And I think the public policy argument against that is, we understand it's hard. We understand this is not fun, but if we all, obey these rules for just a little while longer, 3 months, 6 months, a year, which, you know, in the global scheme of things is not that much. You know, keep in mind, World War II was 4 years. You know, this the coronavirus has been 9 months. This is not a gigantic personal or public sacrifice. You know, there have been much, you know, there have been previous generations of Americans who have made enormous sacrifices in terms of loss of life and time and livelihood that make this pale in comparison. So I think that's the smart public policy argument to say, you know, if we all get together, if we, you know, kind of obey and honor the social compact that we can all beat this together, that it'll be over sooner rather than later.
Let me just ask you about a serious issue, which is there are many Americans who think that whatever is done in the name of religion is okay and can't be touched. We have in New York State, for example, Orthodox Jewish community that likes to go to big weddings. So I'm wondering whether or not the governor, from a political standpoint, endangers himself, or does he write it off and say, okay, those folks aren't voting for me in the first place, when he says this is endangering lives?
Well, I think to the governor's credit, he's not shied away from fights with religious organizations. You know, certainly the restrictions that he announced in Brooklyn during the outbreaks there were sued. He was sued by both the Orthodox Jewish community as well as by the Catholic Church. He won both those cases. And I think that in this moment, I think his kind of broad discretionary powers under the, you know, the emergency powers he was granted by the legislature have withstood most, if not all, legal challenges. So he's on pretty solid legal ground. Certainly, maybe there's a political element or political price to be paid at some point. But once again, he's not facing re-election for another 2 years. That's a lifetime in politics. And also, you know, you look at the polls and he's still riding. I haven't looked at the most recent ones, but he's in the 60s, I think.
Yeah, riding very high.
That's a big number, you know, and also keep in mind, he's a Democratic governor in a state that just keeps getting more Democratic. So I don't think he's particularly worried about any challenges from Republicans. And maybe the biggest challenge would be some sort of primary challenge from Democrats. But, you know, that happened in 2018. And Cynthia Nixon, who had a name and had some support from kind of the progressive wing of the party, got dispatched pretty handily, you know, under a fusillade of money, of course. But I don't think he's particularly worried about, you know, political fallout from what he does during this crisis.
Well, Jesse McKinley of The New York Times, thank you so much for spending this time with us. I always love having you on. You do a great job, and we so appreciate it.
Absolutely. Anytime.